It's springtime right now here in Vancouver. It's also springtime in the place where I come from. Very similar. The fruit trees begin to bud, the daffodils are out. That's one recurrent reality that is so nice and so encouraging. And nobody, no politician anywhere can do anything about it. That's also good. But there's another reality. I must tell you quickly an experience I had a week ago. My wife comes from Seattle, and I took the ferry boat to go to the airport, 45-minute ferry ride, and I wasn't sure where to buy the ticket. I was a bit in a hurry. And there was a young man who passed by me, and I stopped him, and I said, could you help me? I need to buy a ticket. He said, you don't need to buy a ticket. This is only one way. You are now on the other side. It's free. I thanked him. I went to the ferry. And 5 minutes later, this young man had found me in the ferry. And he sat with me. And it turned out to be he was a Navy SEAL. And he looked haggard. He looked run down. And he looked troubled, very troubled. So I engaged him. He obviously wanted to have a discussion. And he said to me, I know you types. You must be an academic. I said, well, whatever I am doesn't matter, but let's talk. And he told me the story. He was as a US Navy SEAL, he was deployed first in Djibouti and then off the waters in Iraq. I said, what was your job? He said, I was involved in testing a killing machine. I said, I beg your pardon, a killing machine. And we didn't go into any detail. I wanted to know what he thought about the war, the occupation, and he said to me, well, we had to go there and occupy. I said, why did you have to go there and occupy? He had no answer for that. And that is frightening when a young man in his 20s is developing himself in a job where he doesn't really clearly understand why he is where he is and doesn't quite know the implications of what he is doing. Well, there's more about this, but that is the other reality. Here's springtime, and here is a reality with which all of us, relatively little, thank God, have to deal with relatively little. Now, tonight's topic, I want to balance this a little bit by talking about Iraq on the one side and on the other side about what kind of a United Nations do we want? Do we need a United Nations? Well, it's a cliche. You have read it maybe before. It has been said not by me, but by others. If there was no United Nations, we would have to invent one. That's what I also believe. I think there is no one, hopefully, in this room who would disagree. We do need a United Nations. But the debate will be about what kind of a United Nations do we need. And there you immediately open up a Pandora's box because you get fantastic views, ridiculous views. One comes from a man you probably read a lot in Canada about, John Bolton, the U.S. representative to the United Nations, who said the other day, the United Nations needs to consist only of one member state, and that's the United States. Well, I'm glad you're laughing, but it's deadly serious. And that's the one extreme. The other extreme is from those who have dreams, and the dreams are that there one day will be one single government, not 191 ministries of finance and 191 ministries of education and 191 departments of social affairs in all the member states, but one global government. Well, that dream, I think the reality of that dream is far, far away from us. And the reality that we look for, I think, is somewhere in between these two extremes. The Financial Times of London said some time ago, the United Nations is vital but flawed. I think that hits it quite well. And we unfortunately talk too much, because that upsets us, about the flawed part and too little about that part which is good, is performing what we would expect from a United Nations. That's the quiet United Nations. The United Nations that deals with primary education, with health care, with water supply, with food and improved caloric intake, with just about anything that any of us would want, would need to live a life in peace and progress. It's for a moment I just want to look at that, because a lot has been achieved. I was 32 years in the United Nations. I'm very proud to say that I joined the United Nations as a German 5 years before Germany became a member of the United Nations, because we only became a member in 1973 because of the two Germanys. There was a hesitation to admit us. I joined in 68. So I think I know the UN and I believe in the UN very deeply. Every single day, in fact, I am happy that I had this experience. So looking back over these 60 plus years that the UN has existed, one can discover a lot of good. Let me superficially just scratch and the surface here and tell you that the structure exists. The UN has an immense network of agencies today that deal with just about anything, again, that one needs to handle, to think about in the national and international context. The oldest United Nations agency is the Universal Postal Union in Bern, Switzerland, that is helping to regulate international postal traffic. There is the International Civil Aviation Organization, headquartered in Canada, that is also a UN agency in Montreal. You have the Maritime Organization in London. You have the Agriculture Organization in Rome. You have UNESCO in Paris. You have the World Health Organization in Geneva, the International Labour Organization. So a whole network of agencies that are doing or trying to do with very little resources the right things. And content has been given to this network over the years. You have had much progress in defining the agenda of these specialized agencies and of the UN Secretariat itself. You've had these big conferences, international conferences, where thousands of people went to Copenhagen to discuss social issues. They went to Vienna to discuss human rights issues. They went to Cairo to discuss population issues. They went to La Plata in South America to discuss water issues. They went to Beijing to discuss the role of women, the rights of women in society. And the press was cynical. The press said, waste of money. Lots of air costs, air traffic costs. What comes out of these? And that always makes me angry, because I was the UN representative in India at that time. And I can tell you, I was highly, at what time? I was in India at the time when Beijing, the women's conference, was being prepared. And the government was working very hard. The NGOs were working very hard. Civic leaders contributed. The UN joined them to debate and discuss what kind of priorities does India have with regard to the rights of women in society. And just before Beijing, the Indian Parliament passed a law to adopt legally the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, the CEDAW Convention. That was fantastic already. They went well prepared. Then in Beijing, they participated actively. They came back. And then there was a whole lot of work that had to follow. So the conference was anything but a waste of time. And the same would apply to some of the other conferences that took place. So we have a structure. We have that network. We have content, increasingly refined content. It's a constant evolution here. And then the third pillar on which this international house stands is international law. And a lot has happened since the United Nations Charter was adopted in 1945. We have since then two covenants that cover civic, political, cultural, social, and economic rights. And we have over a dozen of important conventions, some of which involved very strong Canadian leadership also, for example, the Landmine Convention, where Canada took a lead role. So we have the structure, we have the content, and we have the international body of law. And if we lived in an ideal world, then we could say we really have it. We have what it takes to make our life as prosperous for all of us, because that's what the charter is about, not about some of us, but about all of us, live in peace and be protected by respective international law. The tragedy is that today the gap between where you and I and we are and where we could be with this kind of situation is huge, is wide, and isn't shrinking, unfortunately. And there are many reasons for that. I want to single out two. One is the sheer dynamics of globalization. I'll talk more about it. And the other one is, unfortunately, the unilateralism of a very important country that decided to leave, temporarily, I hope, I'm sure temporarily, the community of nations. Globalization, the challenge will be we are traveling on a road that is increasingly bifurcating. We can go right, we can go left, and the choice is ours, in a way. Certainly the choice is not a choice that is given, but a choice that is what it is. It's a chosen decision. And we could go the road on which it seems we are beginning to travel. And that is what I call the road of market Darwinism, where everything is about profits, about more quantity, more physical quantity, less up here, but more up here. And we had a joke when I served in the United Nations. It's a little bit nasty, and I hope no one is here from the World Bank or retired from the World Bank. But we used to say the World Bank is an institution that emphasizes only that which you can count. What you can count counts, and what you cannot count doesn't count. Well, that's maybe unfair to say that. But that was our impression. That was all about quantity and progress and economics. If you then, I'm glad it's not on this, in a way glad it's not here, but it's a book which is much discussed at the moment in the US and in Europe, John Perkins, The Confessions of an Economic Hitman. Read it. When you read that book, then you know which road some have chosen. What is new in that book, and which is relevant to the Iraq debate, is that here is an unholy, I call it an unholy alliance between economics, politics, intelligence, and finance. I don't want to say more. You can read it. There's a long description about the Saudi Arabian model and how that model helped to create dependency in Indonesia and Saudi Arabia and Ecuador and Panama, political dependency through debt. You lend, you make a country dependent on you, you have a good income, and you falsify the models so that you have a right to charge high, high fees because the growth projections are so optimistic and suggest that you will get out of that with a lot of resources if you decide to enter into a lending program. Well, that is, of course, it turned out not to be so. And Saddam Hussein, whom I absolutely not defend here, he objected to that. And in the book of John Perkins, there's a suggestion that this is one cause why the 1990 dilemma happened, that Saddam Hussein was lured into believing he will be left alone if he attacks Kuwait, and then people in the distance were happy that he did this because that for them was then, of course, the justification to move in and change the policies. So we have another road. It's not that there's another road which to me is immensely more rewarding and in line with what the purpose of the United Nations is. And there's a man for whom I respect a lot. His name is Johan Galtung. He is a conflict researcher for many years, an old man today from Norway, who has all his life tried to argue, make the case for resolving conflicts peacefully. And his definition of globalization is the following. A system in which men and women, the three generations which inhabit Earth at the same time, all races, all classes, live together in dignity. I think that is a magnificent definition of that ideal that I guess the Charter and we all want to pursue. So here we have the issue of choices in which direction we want to take globalization. I've never quite understood why one can be anti-globalization, because globalization takes place whether we like it or not. We must give it direction, I think. Unilateralism, there's a lot of speculation, a lot of conspiracy theories, a lot of nonsense is said and time is wasted. I keep saying to myself and to my friends and those who interact with me, you really need to know, read only two documents. And now, since about 6 weeks, another document. And these are the Project for the New American Century, the PNAC, and what the present administration in Washington did with that document, and that is the National Security Policy of 2002. And then the most worrying recent addition to that is what General Pace, the Chief of Staff of the U.S. military, said to the U.S. Congress just a little while ago. I think it's 6 weeks ago. He submitted the fourth quarterly review to the U.S. Congress, in which he defines that the U.S. and we all must expect what he calls a long war, an involvement in multiple theaters at the same time of the U.S. Army in order to maintain the supremacy, economic, political, cultural, socially, and of course militarily. This is a most recent document. Have a look at it. So this road of unilateralism on which the U.S. decided to travel, the U.S. government, I must be very fair, because there are so many good groups, strong groups, groups around Kathy Kelly, for example, Voices in the Wilderness, and many, many, many others, that it is unfair to say U.S. We have to say U.S. government, U.S. authorities, whatever. They have shown many signs of independence, of colloquial going it alone. They have not signed on the International Court of Justice, as you know. They have not ratified the Landmine Convention, which Canada supported and promoted. They have not signed on the Kyoto Protocol, as you know. But you may not know that out of 191 countries, 189 have signed the Convention on the Rights of the Child, except two countries, one with a government, the other doesn't have a government. The one that doesn't have a government is Somalia, and the one that has a government is the United States. These two have not signed such an innocent convention as the rights of the child. That is amazing, but it shows the loneliness with which political decision-making is proceeding in the U.S. And then, of course, there is the dramatic case that we see, unfortunately, every day. Try to remember when you had a day when you looked at a newspaper in Canada. If it wasn't page one, it was page two or three, or listened to the news, there wasn't something about Iraq. And that brings me to that difficult question, and that is, what about the United Nations here? What did the UN do? And we have to acknowledge that there are immense structural weaknesses that confront the UN, that explain why the UN was not more successful in influencing the Iraq drama. There's much to be said about this. I want to single out just one item here, and that is the freedom with which this United Nations Charter can be interpreted. There are many terms on which, if we were to sit down and write a definition of them, and they are not defined in this document, where we would have different interpretations, different definitions. And then linked to that is, in order to get in the present UN political system, particularly the UN Security Council, anything out, any resolution passed, you must follow the consensus approach, which means you lower yourself to the lowest common denominator, and that usually is imprecise language. And it has taken many, many years. Only last year did the Secretary General, in connection with the need for UN reform, refer to the need to do away with this consensus approach. And he said, consensus promotes generalizations and prevents serious efforts to act. I think that is a very big step forward, because once you verbalize something that is of concern to you, then you have taken a position. He has taken a position, and many people have agreed with him. If that would be taken seriously, things like Iraq must have completed all actions in one resolution. Iraq must fully cooperate. If Iraq does this and that, that constitutes a breach of agreement. And if there is a breach of agreement, there will be serious consequences. Now, four items: completed all actions, fully cooperated, breach of agreement, serious consequence. We all have different views on that. And that was the pretext for, in the end, justifying going to war, because the US and the UK said there's a breach of agreement and the serious consequences are what we define as serious consequences. And the truth, of course, is that the UN never mandated this going to war in March 2003, but it revealed yet again that the United Nations has been unable in having a decisive voice in international conflicts. What have you read about the United Nations and North Korea, I ask you? What have you read about the United Nations and Palestine? What have you read about the United Nations right now and Iraq? What have you read about the United Nations and Iran? Not much. What have you read about international trade and fair trade practices and the United Nations? The World Trade Organization is not a UN body. And there's a very dangerous tendency, watch out for that, to create a parallel United Nations now, outside of the United Nations. The same, for example, with regard to trade, there was a trade body, UNCTAD. The conference on trade in Geneva was dealing with trade issues. That was very much defending fair trade practices, and therefore it became an instrument that was considered as useless as far as the big powers were concerned. So you created the World Trade Organization that is not a UN body. The US is vehemently opposed to the Kyoto Protocol. So they met with Japan and a few other countries to discuss another way of handling pollution, air pollution. So we have UNAIDS is another example. 15 years, I don't remember now the exact year, a body was created, UNAIDS. UNAIDS was supposed to deal with this terrific problem. And WHO, the health organization, UNICEF, UNDP, joined together in order to create a joint effort in the fight against HIV/AIDS. What happened? Suddenly a body with much greater finance was created called the Global Fund, outside the purview of the United Nations, in order to pull away the authority from this UNAIDS that was trying its best to mobilize resources and implement programs. So we see that tendency of creating a parallel body that is more under the traditional thumb of some powers, particularly the US. Well, I think this points, if nothing else, it points to the urgency of UN reforms. Now, to me, Iraq is a fabulous example of what can go wrong in a body that hasn't changed since 1945, when 52 member countries existed, and today when 191 members are in the United Nations. And therefore, I want to speak a moment about the Iraq case. If you have 30 years of dictatorship, if you have two wars, one in 1980 to 88, Iran-Iraq, the second one in 1991, and if you have one illegal invasion in 2003, if you have 13 years of sanctions and you have close to four years of occupation, how much can a nation endure, I ask you? How much can a people carry on their shoulders? This is a nation that is completely traumatized. I challenge you, and maybe you can challenge me when I say there is not one single family in Iraq today that isn't somewhere affected by what has happened in Iraq. Everyone has either lost somebody, somebody is in jail, somebody is maimed, somebody is mentally disturbed. The incidence of mental disease when I was in Iraq during the 1998-99-2000 period, WHO, World Health Organization, already published reports about the increase of mental disease among children in the ages up to 15. It will be much, much worse now. I don't have the figures, but I don't think it's difficult to imagine. So how much more can this nation carry? What is challenging to me today is to quantify a little bit this human catastrophe. It was politically convenient by everyone, by Saddam Hussein, by the British, by the Americans, by the Spanish, by the Italians, and by many others, to sort of make a cocktail and put everything together, all the causes, all the effects, and then you can pick and choose how you want to argue. Well, we mustn't allow that. The academic community mustn't allow that. We as citizens must not allow that. And we can separate what goes into what substance relates to the dictatorship, what substance relates to individual members of the Security Council, and what substance relates to the 15 members of that Security Council as a whole. Very briefly, again, superficially, what goes into the account of Saddam Hussein is very clear. The big picture is painted. We know about the brutality of this dictator. We know what he did with the Kurds in northern Iraq. We know about the Anfal campaign in the mid-90s of the Iraqi military. We know about what happened to these wonderfully, peacefully living marsh Arabs in the southern part of Iraq, a beautiful area, well, rough living, but still a very serene area at one time, where Saddam Hussein, for various reasons, relating to oil, relating to the border, relating to their opposition to him, played havoc with a people. We know about the assassinations of Shia clerics. So the big picture is there. The debate about Saddam Hussein will continue for a long time after he has been executed. It's not much longer. Whether he'll die in a planned execution or through public outcry because they catch him and kill him in the streets of Baghdad, that remains to be seen. But that he will lose his life is pretty clear. But the debate will long afterwards relate to the detail of his brutality. What goes into the account of the occupying powers? I think the deposits are still made every day because they're occupying and the atrocities that are committed, they continue. That's not being anti-American at all. It's just a fact. We have seen it. We have read. We have listened to people. You have Canadians who are traveling there with great courage. Thank God the peacemaker team has been released, but they will have stories to tell. I do want to turn to the account of the United Nations Security Council because I interacted with this council. I met with them fairly regularly, not often enough, but I met. And I want to just say what turned out so badly illegal had a legal beginning. You cannot march into another country and think you get away with that. So when the Security Council decided to pronounce sanctions, that was absolutely correct. But then, for various reasons, there's no time to go into if you want to ask or discuss, it became very quickly illegal between the period of 1990 to 2003. And the price was paid, of course, by people who had nothing whatsoever to do with that political conflict between a government and the international community. There's a saying, an Afghan saying, which I like, which is, grass doesn't stay under the rocks. If you lift a stone and you will see earth, but you won't see grass. The grass comes out on the sides. The facts are coming out, and they're coming out in great clarity. And the almost 2 years that I spent to reflect on my time in Baghdad, to reread the debates in the Security Council, to study the statements that were made by government representatives and the peace movement and CARE and Caritas and the many fantastic international organizations that try to stem the tide, have given me figures, have given me also the conviction that I can look at you and say things which, right after I resigned, I had a lot of feelings and I had a lot of views, but I didn't have the confidence that I really had the figures under control. Now I think I do. And I want to say here, even here in Vancouver, is a debate about the accuracy of some of the figures that were published by the United Nations. For example, about child mortality. And that is good. Let there be an honest, non-political debate about the accuracy, the rigor with which statistics were collected. But I want to remind us here how difficult it was to collect figures in a dictatorship that didn't want certain aspects of the truth to leak out, even though with regard to mortality, they were obviously, it was a political statement to talk about the high incidence of mortality. But let me just say here, before the sanctions began, 25 children under 5 per 1,000, the UN reported were dying for various causes. Then came the sanctions, and when I was in Baghdad, UNICEF published the figure between 100 and 120 children per 1,000 were dying in Iraq. So a tremendous increase. And the gap between what happened before the sanctions and during sanctions cannot be explained, even though Washington and London want to explain it in that way. They cannot explain it that this was because of a dictatorship and Saddam Hussein. It's simply not true. He has done a lot of evil, but he cannot be held responsible for that. The Canadian figure, by the way, is 5. In Canada, 5 children per 1,000 under 5 have, this figure has been very stable over the last years. Where do I get it from? From the UN Human Development Report. Anyway, I could give you now a whole list of examples in different sectors, electricity, education, water, sanitation, where things went from bad to worse as sanctions proceeded. And if you look at these indicators now, they're getting from worse to worst because it hasn't improved. My friends in Baghdad tell me electricity 3 or 4 hours. When I lived in Baghdad, electricity, we had sometimes 8 hours, sometimes less, sometimes maybe an hour more. But now it is worse than it was before. Water supply is poor. Sanitation is atrocious. So nothing has improved. And ladies and gentlemen, these are what I'm telling you here. These are not speculations. These are, as far as the period of sanctions are concerned, these are all facts that can be looked at, that can be, you can do the work yourself and find out what the story is. In this period, when children died at such an increased rate as I mentioned, the United Nations Security Council decided to take 30 cents out of every oil dollar earned and send it to Geneva to compensate individuals, firms, and governments for alleged losses as a result of Iraq's invasion into Kuwait. That is okay. There is nothing really wrong with that. That people who lose, there were a lot of poor workers in Bangladesh and in Iraq, from Bangladesh, from the Philippines, from all kinds of countries, Palestine, and they lost their meager savings and they needed to be compensated. But what I so strongly object to is that out of the $18 billion that were paid up to the end of sanctions for compensation, 15, the major part, was paid out to firms and governments that really could have waited easily a little bit longer until the minimum needs of a nation were satisfied. And some of the examples of the projects that were entertained, you probably will think this man is a skillful manipulator of information and he makes it all sound so easy. No, it's you can check it yourself. You can check if you are persistent enough on the websites, for example, and find out that the government of Kuwait got requested $111 million in one project. It was a small project, $111 million. And the UN Compensation Commission in Geneva decided, not 111, but 177, $177 million. In other words, you have a small car accident, you have a bill from your repair shop for $2,000 Canadian, you hand it in to your insurance company, and the insurance company writes back to you and say, "Dear Mrs. Miller, we are sorry you had the accident. The bill for $2,000, we pay you $3,200. I don't think you'll get such a letter. And the Kuwait received 177 while they expected $111 million. It's just one example. I could give you worse examples. I won't do that. I don't have time. And I don't want any of you to fall asleep. There are many other details, absolutely accurate, researched, and verified details that show you in what dilemma the Iraqi people lived. I could give you now a slate of statistics. I will not do that. But I will try to tell you about the 51-cent scandal, because all that came into Iraq under the Oil for Food program was, on a per capita, per person, per day basis, less than a bagel or a cup of coffee. 51 cent per day. For what? For food, for medicine, for water, for sanitation, for electricity, for agriculture, for education. Education was always the poor child on the block. There was always practically no money left, and it was the last sector that was considered in our negotiations with the government of Iraq for the Oil for Food program, because the other things had more survival value in the short term, food and medicine, of course. So the 51 cents is all that they had. There was no work, there were no taxpayers, and the majority of the Iraqi people had to live on that amount. A school teacher earned between $3 and $5, between, let's say, 8 and 10,000 dinar, and 4 oranges at the street corner near where I lived were 1,000 dinar. No normal Iraqi could buy 4 oranges. But the United Nations, we could buy, and we stopped, and we could buy, and we could have we could enjoy bananas, we could enjoy kiwi, which were imported. It was all there, but only for a very small group of people. And then, you know, it was called humanitarian supplies. I was called the humanitarian coordinator. What was there humanitarian about it? When the money came, the 51 cents came from Iraqi money. This was all Iraqi money. There was not one penny of international money that was contributed to the Oil for Food program. It was entirely Oil for Food program, Iraqi oil revenue. That was the story. There were many gruesome stories also of how the United Nations was misused. Let me give you one example here. You have read in the press that the Secretary General's offices were bugged in New York. You read that, because Claire Short, the minister in London at a time, this was two and a half years ago, publicly stated this, that the British intelligence had bugged the Secretary General's floor. And he was asked about it, and he said, "Well, why did they go through all this? They could have come directly to me. I would have told them the same story, because I have nothing to hide." So there was this nasty awareness that not even the United Nations was protected from the misuse by intelligence services. My office in Baghdad was bugged by everybody. It was bugged by the Iraqis, of course. It was bugged by Israeli Mossad, by CIA, by all kinds. I didn't realize until much later that the little cameras in the corners in our staircases, that they didn't just link us walking up to the disarmament group that was in the same building as we were, but it was linked to Bahrain and to Washington. If you wanted to call me from Canada, the number you would dial was a New York number. It was a 212 number. You would dial that number and you would get me in Baghdad. It shows you how we were all linked into a mesh of legal and less legal operations. The worst example that I had in Baghdad about misuse of the United Nations was when, in my days, 800 ambulances were ready to be shipped into Iraq, and I was told that these 800 ambulances cannot be shipped to Iraq, even though they were badly needed, because they had telephones in them. Now, which ambulance in Canada doesn't have a telephone? You need a telephone to communicate with the doctors in life-threatening cases. So we decided reluctantly they can be removed, and the ambulances arrived in Iraq. I had no ambulances for my staff. We were 500 international staff. We had no ambulance. But the disarmament group of the United Nations had ambulances. And I pleaded with them. I was first told, no, you cannot use our ambulance. One flag, one United Nations. And then after some back and forth, I got agreement that we could use these. And then I found out that not only were there listening devices, but sophisticated, high-tech listening devices were in the ambulances. So I was forced, we were forced to take simple telephones out of the ambulances for use by Iraqis, but in our UN ambulances, we're listening devices. Now that is shameful, and that is so bad that the UN is being misused. Listening devices in New York, listening devices in ambulances. The UN cannot meet your expectations if we are subjected to this kind of bilateral pressure from some sources, some countries. The sanction plus the dot on the I were the no-fly zones. Two zones that were established in northern and southern Iraq, allegedly to protect Kurds and Shias in the north and the south. That was all right. The Kurdish population in northern Iraq liked this afternoon flight of a jet that came over and went through the sound barrier to make really a noise and reassure everyone they were there to observe. This was a benign violation of international law, because it was against the law. There was no UN resolution to sanction these no-fly zones. But then it became progressively aggressive, particularly after Operation Desert Fox in December of 1998, when the two air forces of the UK and the US were allowed to operate under enlarged rules of engagement. That's when the number of civilian casualties increased, when it became nasty, and when it became in the year 2002, it was a pretext for preparing for this war. But it was such an unfair way of operating. It was like two boxers. You tell one boxer not to move, the other boxer is allowed to punch you, and when you start bleeding and you are weak, then they stop and they say, now the fight can begin. This was a little bit like it happened. And I could tell you terrible stories about what this did to the civilian population in terms of further frightening. There was something called the siren syndrome, where children would cling to their mothers when they would hear the sirens announcing that there was another overflight in the no-fly zone. So there was another area here where things went badly against what the United Nations stand for. What does that all mean for the reform debate? To me, two key words are multipolarity and multilateralism. Multipolarity means the United Nations Security Council must not have only a Western avenue, a Western agenda. It must be a global agenda. If we are interested in HIV/AIDS and in terrorism, and the other half of the world is interested in poverty reduction and in finding ways in which we treat each other with greater dignity and tolerance, that must also be on the agenda. A more multipolar situation. It cannot be that we accept, and again, forgive me, that I quote yet again John Bolton. But John Bolton said on the 15th of November last year, The United Nations must be more interested in U.S. priorities. Otherwise, we go elsewhere. I wonder whether he goes to Louisiana or to... where does he go? There is no other body of this kind. But anyway, this is said by the man who is supposed to represent his country at an international body. That isn't how it goes. I don't know where you stand politically, what you think about Lloyd Eggsworthy. I think a lot about him from an international perspective because he came into the UN Security Council in 1999 and he said, quite opposite from what John Bolton said, the United Nations must make sure that it acts for the benefit of the international community and not for the interest of individual member states. And he was kind, wasn't he, that he added an S to member states, because what he really meant was the big brother there that was selfish. And that is, I think, important to remember. The Mexican delegate, I had to read this over and over again to make sure that I read the year 1945. It was said in 1945. If it was said yesterday or last year or even 10 years ago, I wouldn't quote it here. But what he said in 1945 is, we have designed an organization which will control the mice, but the tigers are still on the loose.